tomorrow. As recorded before a live audience in Pasadena, California, Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
I don't know about you, but I want a stake in the future. I want a part of what's going to be happening next year, 3 years, and 5 years from now. As a matter of fact, when I really begin to think about it, I don't know exactly what year it is in which I'm willing to cash in all my chips. I'm not quite sure if I'll be ready to go by 1999 or by 2010 or even 2031 in the month of August on the third day. I don't like to contemplate the day of my approaching death, but once in a great while, and it's happened with, you know, a little bit of recurring monotony after I crossed my 40th birthday. I don't know about the rest of you people if that happens to people after 40. But once in a great while, you kind of look at yourself and you say, hey, I'm not very permanent around this place. The day is going to come when I will no longer be here. That's enormously frightening to a lot of people. If you look around the world today, you will see one of the greatest searches underway by most people is a search for permanency, a search for stability in a chaotic world, a search for security, where you can have no real confidence in basic social institutions, in government, even in your own environment, in the status quo of your present day-to-day life, because of the many things that can come along unexpectedly to shock you out of that status quo and to surprise you. And I have seen in this work, in the church, among people that I have known, an increasing drive and desire for security, for a place to hang your hat and say it's your own, for a place to put some roots down and say that's mine, for a place you can leave the kids, for that little 5 acres somewhere, for the home, for the automobile, for the material possessions that you can say these are mine. A desire in a lot of people's heart to perpetuate a comfortable status quo. Now, no one wants to perpetuate an uncomfortable status quo. We want to get rid of it and change. But when we're happy, when we're basically fulfilled, when we're having the good life, so to speak, then the basic trend of human nature, that of the United States is, I think, an illustrative example among nations as a whole, is to hang on to what you've got. For many years now, the United States foreign policy has been basically aimed at trying to keep it all quiet, trying to keep the Arabs and the Jews from killing each other so that the U.S. and the Soviet Union don't come face to face, trying to kind of have a policy of benign neglect toward Africa and hope that it doesn't erupt in our face, which it seems to be doing now, trying to keep the Organization of African States somewhat tranquilized, pacified, and happy, no matter what Dada Idi, or what his name is, Amin, says. I think he has something like 4 or 5 titles. The guy must be the granddaddy, the emperor, the all-seeing, omniscient, all-knowing, great potentate, besides the big muckaluck. And some of the statements he has made recently I've really got a laugh out of, but I better look out. He may have a secret agent. May hire him and send him over here to get me, so I got to be careful. Apparently they're already killing Kenyans over there. But the United States has tried to follow a policy basically of, let's say, the rich man in the block where itinerant people live, where crime is quite high, where there are a lot of dissatisfied down-and-outers and third-world people living in shanties and shacks. And you have the obvious and the very natural resentment of the poor folks for the guy in the big white mansion on the top of the hill. And the United States is living in a world where the third world countries want what we have and where we're trying to hang on to what we have. Now, by the time a nation becomes so totally affluent, so totally developed, so fabulously blessed in material possessions that it becomes flatulent and apathetic and lethargic, it seeks only to hang on to the existing status quo. And that nation, the moment it does that, has not only stopped growing, but become sick and craven internally. The United States, each new administration, of course, promising that it's going to be a flip-flop, a turnover, we're going to go clean out all the bureaucrats. Every administration has promised that. From the last number of generations that I have known about a presidential promise, either in some of the campaign speeches or in the, you know, the platforms that they adopt, and especially now, of course, both candidates, the way it's going to work out, it looks like, are talking about, well, I'm goes crazy because there's so much candy there he doesn't know what to buy. By the same token, a couple of bucks to the toy store just frustrates the daylights out of a kid. You don't turn a dog loose in a whole warehouse full of dog food with every one of the cans open. You just give him the one can. Because we get frenzied at moments like that. Some people who have an opportunity for the first time in their lives to build their dream home will come up with something which will look so grotesque later on it'll be a landmark and they'll call it somebody's castle. That's a fact. I've seen it happen down through time. So Solomon said he looked on everything that he had wrought, and behold, it was vanity and a pursuit after wind, just an empty hand of wind when he got it. And it was no profit under the sun. So verse 12, he looked at wisdom and madness and folly, the various attributes of the human mind, I guess, of silliness and foolishness, as well as very serious introspective thinking and contemplation and meditation about life and the hereafter and the meaning of life. And he said, for what can the man do that comes after the king? I guess he actually began to feel sorry for other people. Anybody that's born after me will never be able to have any fun because I've done it all. Anybody who comes along and tries to do something, well, I've already done it. And so he said, already that which has been already done. And then I saw that wisdom excels folly as far as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And I perceived also that one event happened to them all. So Solomon was thinking about the future. He was thinking, in short, about death, about the impermanence of life, and about the continual striving in this life to achieve permanence and to achieve real satisfaction, a feeling of total security and of well-being by the things you do, the things you build, the things you plant, the things you develop, the things you buy, the things you possess. And he found out that all of that was a pursuit after wind. He became a candidate for suicide. Verse 17, he says, therefore, I hated life. Now, how can a man, I mean, you know, somebody dives off the bridge because he's all hung up and he can't cope with terrible complexes. He had a terrible childhood. He's had all kinds of philosophical thoughts. He's gone real deep into psychology. He read a book. Somebody told him a story. He hates somebody, maybe himself. Sure, people take their lives. They commit suicide. But how many times do you expect people who've got it all, who've got the yacht and all the racing cars and the fabulous homes and all kinds of income? I mean, Howard Hughes might have been a recluse and had him get the germs out of the apartment and all that, but he sure didn't commit suicide. You know, if you read a little bit about Howard Hughes' early life, you think about some kind of a guy that just about did it all. Kind of like Solomon in a way. What young boy hasn't dreamed of being a pilot? But not only that, but a test pilot, a designer. A guy that comes up with fantastic innovations, came up with a racing plane, broke the world speed record, and then our own Air Force didn't have sense enough to look at it, and so the Germans took a look, and out of that they designed the ME-109, but the Focke-Wulf 190 was a design that came directly from Howard Hughes' own personal design of a winning racer that he flew in the United States. He built that huge, they call it the Spruce Goose, the largest aircraft ever built, bigger than a 747. And he's at the controls and he flies the thing. He built a great big twin-engine bomber. Of course, he crashed it. So he did it all. He ended up getting ribs broken and all the scars that the ladies could, you know, just like the Spanish bullfighter, they could just really get gaga over the terrible scars and just think of what a great guy he was. He married all the best girls in Hollywood, I guess, didn't he? Or some of them, most of them. I forget how many. But it wasn't Jean Peters, his wife, or am I mistaken? But at any rate, I suppose millions of American males, when Jean Peters was at her prime, out there acting on the silver screen, would think, oh man, to be married to Jean Peters. But Howard Hughes did it. So in a lot of ways, he had it all. But apparently, the man was miserable. Apparently, he was quite unhappy. We had reason to know a multimillionaire who owned outright many, many corporations, who was the chief stockholder of U.S. Steel, whose life was developed and spent over making money with money. He earned his first $1 million at age 16. But what a horrible tragedy in his family. His own son committed suicide as a result of a financial squabble with his father. He had no heir. That man was a recluse. People in Los Angeles knew him as an elderly old man with a dusty old coat who would show up in a limousine down in some of the very terrible areas of Los Angeles and go in and buy old shoes and lampshades and use clothing and come up and stash it in his mansion. And he lived this very lonely, reclusive life. It's been years and years ago, and this is by no way an analogy of people who were rich, but do you remember those two brothers who lived in an apartment somewhere in New York City where they lived in a room or several rooms stacked with news? They had a thing on collecting newspapers. They would never throw away a newspaper. When you think of all of the permanence you would like, of the success, of the security, of the money, of the homes, of the goods, and of the things, why not take a lesson from a man like Solomon? What about J. Paul Getty, who once said, "I would give all of my millions for just one happy or successful marriage"? What about some of these very, very wealthy men who say they can't trust anyone because if they were to allow the barriers to be dropped and they were to allow their heart to get involved and to really begin to like someone, what if they find it's just one more case of someone who wants their money? I believe similar statements were made by H.L. Hunt, who felt that so many people were just after his money and was not all that trusting. Most people, when they become very wealthy, are that way. Then they have to jealously guard that money. They got to protect that empire. They got to watch over their possessions. They've got to constantly be jealously and vindictively fighting to keep what they've got. The fight to get there, I guess that was exhilarating, but oftentimes that broke their health and made them a very wasted individual. That's true of some of those who are in the multimillion bracket today. Lives are wasted physically. They can't enjoy the same kind of a sound diet that you might. At a much younger age, the doctor might tell them they can't eat the same things you can. They can't enjoy sports and running around because they got to watch the old heart. And they're sick all the time. They've got all kinds of problems. They can't sleep at night. So here was Solomon that did it all and had it all and then still said, "I hated life because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me for all his vanity and a vexation of spirit." He said, "I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun because I would have to leave it unto the man that should come after me." He wanted to hang on to it. Now, they like to say, you know, you can't take it with you. We don't like to believe that. We like to somehow think, yes, we can. Now, no one ever did, but we like to think we're going to be different for some reason. He says a little later on in the fourth chapter, in verse 6, "Better is an handful." This is a great spiritual principle, but you show me the average American wallowing in affluence who really believes it. "Better is an handful with quietness than both hands full with travail and vexation of spirit."
This topic will be continued on the next edition in series of The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Good News magazine. In addition to his many speaking engagements, Garner Ted Armstrong also serves as editor of Good News magazine. This full-color monthly publication underscores the importance of biblical understanding in modern 20th century living. The Good News Magazine. Your subscription is free of charge. There is no cost or obligation. The Good News. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.